Is it the case that some houses you can't demolish and rebuild, or does it depend on municipality and area, or?
It depends on zoning regulations. So
Okay.
anything of this age obviously was built in a time where there weren't many zoning regulations to speak of, or
Right.
they were far lax, far more lax. And then these days you have to have a certain distance between the property line and the structure. You have to have an access way that is at least 4 meter wide to allow for emergency vehicles. So a lot of properties, the agents will always tell us if it's not written in the listings, but a lot of properties cannot be rebuilt. But as long as, depending on local municipality regulations, they're each a little bit different. But normally, as long as the foundation and at least one or more of the supporting walls are still in place, anything you do is considered a renovation legally, not a rebuild.
Right.
So in
Okay.
most cases, that wouldn't be an issue unless, I don't know, severe earthquake, the foundation is demolished as well, and then yes, it's a rebuild. And
Right.
but your insurance covers you for that. So they'll, depending on how much you chose, and insurance is very cheap in Japan, so we'd always go for maximum coverage. The insurance company will pay you the cost of a complete new rebuild. So even if you bought
Oh,
this
wow.
property for 3 million yen, you'll get 14, 15 million yen so that you can rebuild, if not on this land plot, on another one. Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajimam again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over 2 decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so for today's episode, these are two back-to-back calls with potential buyers, both looking for Akiya holiday homes, both interested in renting the properties out for short-term stays whenever they're not using them. But the property profiles, locations, and the topics that they were interested in, while similar in many aspects, also had plenty of nuances that I thought you'd find interesting, if Akiyas are your jam too, that is. So this first call is with a buyer from the US who's also a bit of a DIY enthusiast and carpenter slash builder. And we talk about buying super cheap abandoned homes and renovating them, who those types of projects are actually suitable for, the difference between modern and traditional Japanese architecture and building methods, yard and garden maintenance costs, water and sewage supply facilities, and how all of that should play into due diligence costs and quality of living at the property. We also discuss zoning regulations and non-rebuildable properties. What do those mean? And then we do some live deal analysis as well. So you might want to hop over to the YouTube channel for this one. We'll link to this video in this episode's show notes. We lastly then discuss how viewings and inspections work, how short-term stay licensing and management works, and much, much more. So enjoy this first chat, and I'll see you again right after this. So I've browsed through your email. I've got a few reservations that I would like to share. So give me a second. The first thing is $25,000 is going to buy you a dilapidated shack. We're not talking about renovations usually in the of the type that you'd be, I mean,
interior you might be able to do on your own, some of the exterior, mm-hmm. but you're talking about several times the price of the property again in renovations, right? So if you're buying for 25 and end up spending 75, why not buy something a bit younger that's in better condition?
Right, right.
I mean, they exist, those cheap houses, definitely. I mean, that's what Michael's newsletter is all about, but they're usually purchased by people who are either into a hardcore hands-on labor of love project where they live in the property for 3 years and do everything themselves with local carpenters sourcing cheap materials, that kind of thing, and then yes, it's a bargain. Or alternatively, they buy it for the value of the land and they're assuming that they're going to demolish and rebuild or set up a prefab or something of that sort. So we would normally say, let me see, what's the yen to dollar at the moment? So if 25,000 US is at the moment about 3.6 million yen. I think we'd normally recommend, depending on location, Toyama, I'd say, would not be too expensive. So let's say, what's 50,000? 50,000 will give you about 7. Yeah, so 50,000-60,000 is where you're starting to look at stuff that might not need serious structural renovations. And I mean, look, there are diamonds in the rough, so we can look at a bunch of cheap properties, but you will want to conduct a structural inspection on each and every one of them, and each of those would cost you about $1,000 US.
So I remember you saying that from
the likelihood of these older, cheaper properties having structural issues is a lot higher. So if you end up, you know, paying for inspections on 10 properties, that's another $10,000
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're the boss. We'll help you buy whatever you want. But our advice would be to aim for something starting at around 7-8 million yen if you want something that will not have severe issues.
Yeah. I'm just thinking back to your conversation that you had with the Akiyama guys. Yeah, those guys. So I heard on the podcast the place that they mentioned in Beppu. Yeah. And I think they were like around 42 or 45,000.
Yeah, but have you seen the videos of the work that they've done on it after purchase?
No, that's what I was going to mention. So I think
they were there for a year doing a lot of handyman jobs themselves, cutting out portions of the house. They did have to bring in some people, but they were there to do it themselves. In your case, it's at the moment a holiday home, right?
Yeah.
So
it would have to be done in chunks, like taking a month or a few months at a time.
And are you the DIY type? Can you
do up? I worked as a carpenter before, and built some structures and things. So
as long as you're okay with it being a long-term project that you come back to whenever you're here, and
So that would definitely be the plan. But like you said, there's a certain point of diminishing returns where if it gets to a certain level of labor and cost and, you know, messes, then it could just make sense to go into a higher bracket. The ability to do many things myself, though of course there's limitations, like I don't do electrical, so I would need contractor for electrical, certain, you know, plumbing, things like that. So for me it'd be mostly carpentry, floors, ceilings, even replacing beams and stuff. I'm comfortable with that.
How about roof, foundation, tilting, sinking?
Foundation, tilting, no. Roof to a certain extent, replacing existing or framing out a roof, yes. Especially if, and it depends on what roof, you know, you can do the more modern metal, or if you're trying to replace and keep it traditional. Well,
the other thing is, I'm as far from a handy person as humanly possible, so take everything I'm saying with a grain of salt, but I'm assuming from the looks of things that certain, I know, for example, I've interviewed an architect who moved from the US to Japan and was working with Japanese carpenters. So he said that when they were setting windows, the methods that they were using were completely different to what she was used to in the US. And I'm assuming from the looks of roofs that they would be the same in Japan. Probably not everything would be exactly the same.
Yes. And I think especially if you're looking at a 120-year-old house, like things are built differently.
Those record all of those with the traditional elements, you know, the huge wooden pillars, that like the Kominka, the old style pre-World War II countryside homes. Those traditional features will require specialist artisans to work on them, and even the normal renovation companies here in Japan would not have those skills.
Yeah,
so you bring in specialists, and I mean, those houses are actually built to last a lot longer than the modern builds.
Right.
They will stay there for another 100 years. But when you do need to do any work on those traditional elements, everything will cost 4 or 5 times as much because you'll have to bring in specialists.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, yeah, so that is something to consider as well.
And it is a dying art, so it's probably going to get more expensive as the years go by, not cheaper.
Yeah, I've noticed sometimes too, like roofs that were originally thatched roofs, they've replaced them with metal, but it's happened so long ago that even those sheet metal is rusted. So that would need to be done in like a more modern roofing style, which is not a, like you can find a lot of roofers that will do that normally, but if you have roofs that are shaped like this, then it becomes a bit trickier. So
yeah, I mean, there are Western built homes in Japan, so you could conceivably get the materials and do stuff the way that you used to in the US, but I'm not sure how cheap those particular materials would be to source here.
Right. Yeah.
I'm assuming custom made homes cost more for that reason, that the stuff that they use to build them is usually imported.
Yeah. The from what I've seen just on the research that I've done and watching people that do it on their own, there's certain things, like you said, if it's a traditional roof, you're just going to find someone. If it's updating a bathroom or a kitchen or something like that, then it's going to be pretty much similar as we do in North America, or I'm Canadian, but yeah, America, same thing. So
well, I mean, the bathrooms in those older homes are usually old traditional like deep metal tubs.
Yeah,
right. To replace, so if you want to replace the entire room, the cheapest way to do it in Japan is with what's called a unit bath, which was like a single piece, like you find in a Japanese hotel room, single piece fiberglass or plastic enclosure. So you could strip it all and put in a, you know, typical Western shower if you wanted to. But again, everything that's not the norm here would cost more parts and materials wise.
Right. A question I wanted to ask in regards to your point about the price point in the range.
Yep.
So there's the places that I have steered clear of where, like, you know, there's the $0 homes, the $5,000, the $10,000. Those I kind of assumed are going to be near teardowns or, you know, $50,000 worth of work. I was kind of assuming based on, and I know pictures can be deceiving, which is why I wanted to look in person. But I was assuming when you get, you know, north of 20 or 25,000, you're getting a little bit more, you know, quality or like still life left in the home compared to the tens and the $5,000-$7,000
homes. It could also depend on the size of the land plot.
Okay.
And it's not necessarily reflective of the age and general condition of the home, but if they know that there are, like, for example, if the seller already knows that there are certain things that would have to be fixed or replaced, then they would just try to reduce the price as much as they can. A lot of those are just being sold cheaply because the owners want to stop paying the property tax on them.
Right.
So generally, yes, but not always. It's worth looking into it on a case by case. But did you want me to do you want to look over the two listings that you sent together? Maybe just feedback as we look at them will probably
help
explain what I'm talking about.
I think so. Yeah, I think that'd be great.
I have
them on links if you need.
No, I got them here. Okay. You seeing my screen?
Yep.
Okay, so 3.3. 1959. So obviously in this case the price is mostly due to the age. I'm assuming this one doesn't specifically differentiate between the land and the floor plan, but if this is the floor plan of the house, that's about double the size of your typical Japanese family home. So just again, bear in mind that anything that you, generally speaking, if we say normally for a house this old, maybe expect something like between 3,000 to 5,000 average on year for annual maintenance and repairs. But here you've got double the floor plan, so expect more than that. And again, everything that we've discussed, all of these traditional features will need specialists to maintain and repair and renovate whenever that's needed.
Right.
Another thing to consider is your backyard, your garden. The more bushes and trees there are in there, and especially if those are near the boundary lines, meaning they might be overhanging roads or neighboring properties, you will have to religiously maintain those. And when you're not here, that means fairly expensive gardening contractors. So again, that could bring up your maintenance a good few hundred bucks a month. If you're just talking about general weeding and you know, a little bit of trimming and stuff, that's usually not going to be more than 100 a month. But the more bushes and trees and the closer they are at the boundaries, yes, like see all of these guys here and that little tree there, they will have to be maintained regularly, and that would cost. So the interior has been partly done, which is nice. The bathroom, yeah. So from the looks of it, you could definitely take your time with this one. It doesn't look like it's falling apart. But again, structural inspection notwithstanding, the naked eye obviously can't tell us what's happening in the deeper areas. And then, water supply private to me suggests maybe well water. Well water can be unreliable because number one, the supply, it can just dry out and it'll end at some point. The other thing is that you have to constantly monitor the water quality, and if it's gone bad, then you're not going to be drinking in it anymore. In some cases, depending on what's in it, you might not even want to bathe in it. Which means that you'll have to probably recommend it, and at some point you might have to connect to city water supply.
Right.
Depending on how far the pipes go in your area, if that's even possible, that again might cost, let's say, 1 million, 2 million yen, because you'll have to run pipes from your boundary line all the way to the house.
Right.
And that looks like a fairly big land plot. So that, very big land plot, right? So, yeah. Sewage is public, which is good, but I'm assuming, oh, the toilet was done, right? I saw in the photos the toilet looked fairly new. Yeah, so again, structural inspection notwithstanding, the things I would consider with this one is the land plot and water supply would be my main concerns, regardless of structural issues, which we still don't know about.
Okay.
Now I'll open the second one.
So just to what we've talked about so far, with the interior, like for that price point, assuming the inspection was showing something good, am I correct in thinking that one potentially could be quite a good value for what it is, all things considered, land size, if inspection was passed? You know, it looks like they've done a lot of work, or at least upkeep in the interior so far.
Yeah. Probably, but again, I would be wary of annual maintenance costs, because you're looking at a good, I'd say with this yard and the size of this house, you're looking at a good few thousand bucks a year in annual maintenance, even once everything is okay. That's the only thing. And the other thing would be to check how much it would actually cost to connect to public water supply and whether that's even possible.
Okay. Is it a requirement to have like hire a professional company that does this? Or if you have someone who is in Japan all the time, is not that far, and they're willing to go there, like a friend that you would hire, for example, or have some kind of agreement, and they can do some basic landscaping. Does it have to be?
You can use whoever you want, of course.
As long as it's
homeowners do it on their own all the time. So yeah, no problem.
Right. So what the municipality cares about is that it's looking presentable consistently week over week, I guess?
Less so looking presentable. More a case of not being a hazard or a nuisance. So, for example, if your weed is overgrown and vermin could nest in there, that's a problem. And if it's overhanging neighbors' boundary lines or public roads, that's something that has to be taken care of. And neighbors in Japan have very low tolerance for a single leaf peeking over their fence kind of thing.
Yeah, of course. Okay.
So this other one, that's really cheap. Okay, here I'm guessing the roof will have to be completely gone.
Yeah, so this is one I actually had my friend in Japan speak to the real estate agent just by phone and just ask about the roof. They said the roof used to be a thatched roof. They replaced it with metal. The metal has rusted, but there's no leaks on the main part. It's actually structurally very good. But the secondary roof, that they traditional think, part
I'm
where you
assuming they haven't done an inspection because roof surface inspections of the roof are a lot more expensive.
Right. But they did say that the lower roof, that kind of part where it has the traditional tile, that does have leaks down onto the balcony. So that would
that
need to
part.
Be redone.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's exterior, I believe, but of course, still going to be pretty significant.
Well, for reference, if we were to, I'm not sure how much it would cost to demolish and dispose of the existing one, but if we were, if it was a tile roof and we were to completely replace it, you're talking 3-4 million yen.
Okay.
And here there's no information about sewage and water supply, so that's definitely something that we'll want to look into. With sewage, if it's city sewage, obviously that's great. If it's a septic tank, that's not too bad. I mean, $300-400 a year in maintenance, but nothing crucial. But if it's what they call here a pump toilet or kumitori system, which is essentially just a big shit pit under the house, that you'll want to replace as soon as possible because they stink.
Right.
And replacing them again would be normally, depending on the lay of the land and how far people would need to drive to get there. But if you're installing a septic tank, that's usually going to be about $8,000 to $10,000, maybe a bit more, depending on the layout.
Okay.
And connecting to city sewage, if it is possible, could also be 2-3 million yen.
Mm-hmm.
So this one will definitely cost you the price of the house again. And I'm guessing maybe 2-3 times the price of the house again.
Wow. Okay.
Also, the interior is a lot less. A lot less nice than the previous one, right?
This one, the location right near the ocean was very attractive, and more so than the interior of the house and exterior as well. It's right near the beach, so.
Yeah. So, yeah, this one hard to say. There's not much information in the listing, so we'll have to make inquiries and find out.
All right.
Unless I'm missing anything. Yeah, no mention of sewage and water, which is my main concern. From the looks of that toilet, I'm assuming it might still be on a pump toilet, but we'll have to talk to the agent and find out.
Okay.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know. They're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own. But longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home, with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today, see how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now, back to the podcast.
So yeah, those are the kinds of things we look at. But beyond that, it's a case of what the structural inspection will reveal. And the older the house, the more likely that it's going to reveal some major issues. So again, roof, we can kind of quantify.
Right.
But tilting, sinking, termite tracks, which would indicate a past termite infestation, we can deal with the infestation if it's still there, but we never know how deep they got into the beam.
Right. Okay.
So
And
again,
then
you're a carpenter, so maybe some of these things are less scary for you than a typical homeowner, but still they could cost a lot.
yeah, and structure's always a little scary. I'm on the west coast of like Vancouver Island. We don't have termites, so we don't have to consider it. So I'm always very nervous about termite infestation. So I think that's a very valid point.
I
When
am
it
too,
comes
but I had a customer from Australia, for example, that looked at a house. He saw the termite tracks; they were there. He didn't even need an inspection; they were very clear there. And he was like, "Yeah, termites don't scare me. I know how to deal with it." I'm like, "Okay, if you know how to deal with them, that's great." But most of our customers, we would recommend not to go ahead if anything like that is found.
Right. Yeah. The replacing like some beams, even tearing up floors and replacing cross beams and supporting, like that part doesn't scare me so much. But when it starts to do anything that's just, if you're ripping apart a roof or it gets really structural, and it's just sometimes, like you said, not worth the effort and the cost. So that's even with a DIY lens, I'm still keeping that in mind. I think that's a very valid point as well.
But with tilting and sinking as well, the other part of the equation there is that it could indicate land liquefaction issues. And that's not even structural. That's a whole different kettle of fish, right? Then you have to bring in people that can actually repack the land for you, do some testing to make sure that it is feasible to rebuild there. It's we get into like a whole different territory there. So again, tilting and sinking beyond the norm, and the inspection company will tell you whether it's within the norm or not, is something that we would probably, cracks in the foundation, stuff that's probably going to start edging into too expensive to replace kind of thing. Because if you're going to be spending like a typical complete renovation, exterior and interior of a Japanese home is usually going to be around 10 million yen. And building a new home is about 15 million yen. So unless there's a very compelling reason to retain the old structure, like that first house with a beautiful architecture, it often starts edging into, well, might as well demolish and rebuild.
Is it the case that some houses you can't demolish and rebuild, or does it depend on municipality and area, or?
It depends on zoning regulations. So anything of this age obviously was built in a time where there weren't many zoning regulations to speak of, or they were far lax, far more lax. And then these days you have to have a certain distance between the property line and the structure. You have to have an access way that is at least 4 meter wide to allow for emergency vehicles. So a lot of properties, the agents will always tell us if it's not written in the listings, but a lot of properties cannot be rebuilt. But as long as, depending on local municipality regulations, they're each a little bit different. But normally, as long as the foundation and at least one or more of the supporting walls are still in place, anything you do is considered a renovation legally, not a rebuild. So in most cases, that wouldn't be an issue unless, I don't know, severe earthquake, the foundation is demolished as well, and then yes, it's a rebuild. And but your insurance covers you for that, so they'll, depending on how much you chose, and insurance is very cheap in Japan, so we'd always go for maximum coverage. The insurance company will pay you the cost of a complete new rebuild. So even if you bought this property for 3 million yen, you'll get 14, 15 million yen so that you can rebuild, if not on this land plot, on another one.
That's good to know.
The only other caveat with non-rebuildable is that lenders will not lend for it. So if and when you want to resell it, you'll be limited to cash buyers like yourself.
Interesting. Okay. I have a question about the water you mentioned. So when it doesn't say, or I think you said it likely could be well water, and you need to get that tested. That's its own testing, I'm assuming, separate from the inspection, the actual home
Yes.
inspection. That's going to be like somebody who specifies in water and water
Yes, water
testing.
quality company. Depending again on location, the type of the well, and how far they need to travel, usually somewhere between $100 to $500 for the inspection, for the water quality inspection. But
You
you'll have
said
to
it's
do
about,
that every few months or at least once a year.
right. You said it's typically about 1,000 for the home inspection, correct?
Correct.
US?
Yes. And
1,000
a few
US.
hundred dollars for the water quality inspection usually.
Okay. That's very helpful.
But regardless, a well could definitely dry out. So you want to at least find out how much it will cost you if and when that happens to connect to city water. And in some areas, right. if it's very rural, maybe there is no city water supply in that area. Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Okay.
I mean, obviously, there are solutions, bottled water for drinking, rain collection tanks for bathing. I mean, Japan's a fairly humid country, so you're probably not going to be left out to in the dry, but it's not a convenient arrangement, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's important. Okay. And then you mentioned going to see these houses. It takes time, it sounds like, to set up a viewing, even if I'm on Japanese soil in a month from now. Is that too soon? Or
A month from now is right on target. We would ask people to give us a month usually. If we're lucky, we'll get it done quicker. But depending, because the way it works is being a foreigner, I'm assuming not being fluent in Japanese, we need to work through someone like ourselves or a buyer side agent who can service you in English. Mm-hmm. And then your side party needs to contact the listing agent, who's very traditional Japanese usually, explain everything. And between their schedule or our schedule and the listing agent's schedule, these things can take, like, for example, I know that I and most of the agents we work with are usually booked a week or two in advance. Mm-hmm. And same goes for the listing agent. So we can usually get it done within less than a month. But to be on the safe side, we ask to give us that.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to be in Toyama on the 1st and the 2nd of October.
That's enough time. That should be fine.
Okay. Okay. It's right at the end of the trip. So I'm going to keep also looking at a few places. I've pretty much already in my mind have disqualified the roof one. Like I'm kind of reconsidering the what the listing shows and what it means in regards to budget with renos, even from a DIY perspective. So yeah. I think that's very useful.
Now the second part. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I'll ask after.
Sorry. Okay. So the second part of your message there was talking about potentially down the track running this as an Airbnb a short-term stay operation of some sort. So
yeah,
if that is a prime criteria, then before we actually go ahead and you know spend money on investigating a particular property, the first thing we want to check is whether it's likely to receive a license, because compliance is quite strict in Japan. Mm-hmm. So we would be floating potential listings to a short-term stay research and management company.
Wow.
And they will charge you 20,000 yen for the first property in any particular municipality, and then 10,000 yen for any subsequent property in the same municipality.
Okay.
And they will provide a detailed written report to let you know if that property, based on that local municipality regulations, if that property is likely to receive a license, and if not, what you'd need to do to it to comply with the license requirements.
Right.
Sometimes it's going to be a case of, look, this property is within 500 meters to a public school and the local municipality doesn't allow that, then there's no amount of renovation that'll fix that. So if that's a prime criteria, we want to dig into that before we start spending money on other things.
Right. Okay. That's very helpful. Yeah, that's very good to know. That was one question that I had as well, just what are the disqualifiers for municipalities? But it sounds like with, you know, barring the school distance and things that can't be changed, a lot of it's going to be in regards to what the actual property looks like, what the quality and the condition that it's in. That's going to be a big...
It's more a case of the layout. And again, things like how wide is the access road for emergency vehicles. The short-term stay management company, the one that I work with usually, but there might... Depending on the area, if it's not very touristic, there's probably not going to be any short-term stay management companies. It's not worth it for them to set up shop there. And you do need a licensed management company to manage the property if you're not there handling guests yourself.
Right.
Which means that the property that I work with and a few other ones, the company that I work with and a few other ones, they can manage the property remotely on your behalf if the local municipality allows it. So they'll put in automatic check-in, check-out locks. But the main hurdle for them is, can they get local cleaning companies in that area? Because cleaning can't be done remotely. Somebody has to physically go there and do that.
Yeah,
that's usually for them the make or break. So if they if they research and find that they can't get any reliable cleaning company in that area, they're not going to be able to do that.
Okay.
And then the alternative would be for you to, depending on the size of the house and if it's going to be profitable enough, which is a totally different discussion, but you might want to hire someone to live or somebody who lives close to the property to handle cleaning and be there physically on your behalf in lieu of a licensed management company.
Yeah, that was probably the route we were going to go, because I do have a couple of contacts that are young, pretty open schedules, looking for work, trust, family,
Okay.
friends, those kind of things that are
Okay.
Japanese native. So those were kind of, yeah. But again, people are not always, their plans can change depending on how long things take too. So it's good to know about the management companies as well
Yeah,
and some of the
the question I
potential
usually
hurdles.
ask our customers is this a good to have situation, or is this like really part of the plan? Like if you're strategizing, and you're definitely planning to run a hospitality business there, then we'd better do checks in advance. But
Right.
if not, then we can buy the property and then try to apply later and see how lucky we get.
Yeah, for us, it's the priority is to have the home, to spend time there, on vacation. My wife works remotely. I'm currently a stay-at-home dad. So we would be able to go and spend time there, what the visa allows, under 3 months at a time or what have you, or the 180 days. But if it's a thing where it's like this home won't qualify until XYZ is met, that's okay with us. But if it's a this home will never qualify because of the zoning, we would probably be better off looking elsewhere because it's not, this isn't, we're not trying to get rich off the Airbnb here. It's not the sole reason we're doing it, but of course it's an important piece. We would like it to make its money back over a course of
Cover
years.
costs, but yeah,
Yeah,
I.
cover costs over years. So, if we
But in
have to
that
even
case,
change.
we'll need to conduct that short-term stay research before we actually go ahead and start paying for people to view the property and structural
Right.
inspection and all of that.
There's companies I've looked on, and I know there's probably more nuances than this, so this is just kind of my general start to looking, but there's a couple AirDNA and Airbitix, and you can just look up an area on the map and it'll show you how many Airbnb properties are there. And I think even so, but
If they're
like you said,
listed
if
on
there's a distance.
Airbnb, if they're listed on Airbnb, they have to be licensed.
Yeah,
Otherwise,
right.
Airbnb will not let them list. So if you're seeing a bunch of them in close proximity, that's a good sign that it is zoning-wise, it is possible. And then it's just a matter
Right.
of whether this particular property will comply.
Okay. Yeah. That's okay. Perfect. Can I ask you a question about general just geography of Japan in regards to these things? Do you
Yeah, of
still
course. But I
did you have a
noticed
hard?
your our time is running out, yeah?
Yeah, so I have eight because I have the free Zoom. I have 8 minutes left that'll bump us out.
Yep. Go for it.
Okay, so I'm kind of look I've in the past month or so really upped my understanding of geography in relation to being in Japan. When it comes to certain areas, what I've been doing is browsing the location and looking at every place within a price point. And if it has more than a couple desirable or potentially desirable ones, I'll kind of zone in on that area and then keep looking more specifically. Because of course, as you know, there's thousands to look at. So I kind of have like, this is my preferred. If that doesn't work out, we look over here. Places that have a ton of Airbnb, like obviously anywhere around Kyoto, but it's just so touristy. There's so many Airbnbs. I think there's over 3,000 Airbnbs in the prefecture of Kyoto. So is it, and I'm not talking about profitability or business-wise, but just regulation-wise, like municipality-wise, you're more likely to have, I suppose, a place that's easier to make it qualify for these types of things
No,
because
that's
tourism
actually
is a hotbed.
tricky. No, it's tricky
No.
because Kyoto, for example, is one of the strictest places in the country when it comes to short-term stay legislation. And the reason you're seeing so many properties there is because it's such a heavily touristed area. It's probably Japan's second, right after Tokyo, I think,
Right.
that it's worth it for people to go through the motions to buy expensive property and
I
renovate them
see.
because during high season in Kyoto, they can charge $1,000 a night, right?
Wow.
So
Okay.
they make it worth their while.
I see.
Osaka City, for example, just an hour or so south of there, is actually a designated short-term stay friendly zone where you can rent properties out throughout the year, even with a casual license, not just half the year like most of the country.
Oh.
Okay. Chiba City, an hour to the east of Tokyo, same thing, special short-term stay designated friendly area. And in those places, it's a lot easier to get a license. So,
Okay.
and obviously, there's, not as many as Kyoto, but Tokyo has a Tokyo is different because it's not an actual city. So each local municipality within Tokyo has their own regulation.
Right.
But a couple of the city wards within Tokyo are actually a lot more lax than other parts of the city. So seeing that there are many Airbnbs there is not necessarily an indication now.
Okay, that's very helpful context. Is it general that those specialty zonings, does that apply typically only to the less rural places? Like it's more in
Not
the
really. Each
city? No.
municipality makes their own rules. It's more a case of how resistant the local population is to seeing foreigners coming in and out of town. The
Okay.
local municipality doesn't want to deal with too many complaints, so if it looks like the
Interesting.
locals are insular, then they're just going to make it strict.
Okay. And that could happen modern living or rural living, I
Yeah,
suppose, just
it could
depending
even
on the
happen in an
area.
area which is currently friendly but has been receiving too many complaints. So next year they'll change the regulations, and then everybody will have to scramble and catch up. When the new legislation came in that allowed the local municipalities to dictate their own rules, Airbnb had to scrape about 80% of the listings on their website and then start the licensing all over again with the remaining hosts. So that's always a danger, but that's a danger in any country. I mean, people complain too much about Milano in Italy. The same thing happens there, right?
It's part of the reason it's not our retirement plan. It's not our main business. It's just something that we want to get money back out of if possible. If they turned around and said, you're not allowed to do this, it wouldn't mean we're leaving or we're getting rid of the house. It would be disappointing, but
Well,
it's not the main,
monthly rentals are considered a normal rental. It's not short-term stay legislated. So anything that's done for a period of at least 1 month and with an actual tenancy lease in place, which can be just like a single page template, that nobody can tell you. You can do that anywhere you want.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there are property managers that specialize in monthly rentals, but the more rural the property, the less likely you're going to have those in those areas. But you can set up your own private channels, and like you said, hire somebody to do their to stay there. I mean, if it's a monthly, they don't have to stay there. They'll just have to come in once a month or once 2 months whenever somebody moves out. But you can do things, but then it becomes you'll have to create your own marketing channels, and you'll have to promote the area because you're going to be pretty rural. Maybe there's not that many tourist attractions there. You'll have to make the entire area look attractive to potential guests, not just the house itself. So it becomes a bit of a hands-on job.
Regards to your fees and prices, I looked over the whole document. With the timing of things, how
So
does that
I'll
work?
caveat everything that you read in there to say that we're a bit swamped with clients at the moment, so we're not going to be onboarding anyone for full facilitation until the end of the year or early next year. What I've been doing in the last 6 7 months, since we became a bit too swamped and started hiring and training new staffers, which will still take us some time. So I've been putting people in touch directly with a foreigner-friendly English-speaking realtor who can handle the logistics of the purchase in English remotely on your behalf, same as we would have done. They're still realtors, so the kind of conversation we just had, they're not going to have with you. You just point them at properties and they help you buy them. That's their job, basically. So I've been coming in as just consultant for a few hundred bucks, just holding people's hand along the way,
I see.
reviewing documents before you sign them, guiding due diligence just to make sure everything's done correctly and not, avoiding costly mistakes. So the process will be similar, except you'll be talking directly to them and I'll be on the sidelines consulting and holding your hand. It's a lot cheaper as well. So if you want to pull the trigger before we can onboard people fully, then we can start doing that anytime.
That's great. Yeah, I'd be happy with in either case, I think.
So both ways work, depending on your timeline and depending on how much you want to spend.
I think that answers any questions that I had, other than just to clarify, if I want to view those places in Toyama, the language for those viewings won't be an issue because I will have a friend who's a native speaker there with me. Like, he will be coming with me to the house. He'll be with us anyway. So, the language part isn't an issue if that's helpful to know. Like, if the real estate agent comes there and they have zero English, that's okay. But
That's going to
if
be
I give
most of
you,
them in those areas.
right.
By the way, if we get hung up on, let's jump to WhatsApp and continue there.
Yeah.
Because you'll have the 10-minute wait with Zoom, right?
Oh, right. Yes. Okay. And yeah, I still have 1 minute. Okay, so about a month notice is what you would want to see. If I had sent you maybe, let's say, I'm going to get rid of the roof one, but if I send you two more listings in that same area, then you're able to make the connection still.
Yes, now is a good
Okay.
time for that.
Oh, okay, perfect. Okay, great.
All right. So message me on WhatsApp when you want to get started. Give me the listings, and I'll start a chat group with that foreigner-friendly agent, and we'll take it from there.
Okay, amazing. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Great speaking to you.
Okay, you
Talk to you
too.
soon.
Thanks, Ziv.
Bye.
Bye now.
Now, here's some big news for anyone interested in Akiya, the abandoned vacant homes that are abundant all around Japan for very attractive purchase prices. Akiya Mart, our latest sponsor, is a recently founded online search and discovery tool for Japanese real estate. Its user interface will be very familiar to users of Zillow or Redfin. The platform essentially scouts the internet for property listings, translates them into English, and displays prices in US dollars, all in one place and with a dynamic map interface that makes browsing, finding, and shortlisting your favorite properties a piece of cake. Which any of you have been struggling with the dozens, if not hundreds, of Japanese property websites that are available online and their very clunky interface will probably find a real blessing. They've got already over 500,000 listings on the platform, and the database is expanding daily. Ranging from abandoned rural homes to luxury urban properties, Akiya Mart makes it easy to find your dream home in Japan, regardless of your budget. Now, while the platform is essentially free for use, here's an exclusive offer for listeners of the podcast. You can use the promo code NTI to receive $5 off Akiya Mart Pro. The subscription will unlock a bunch of very attractive features for you, including unrestricted access to the entire nationwide property database and a whole range of filters, which will help power charge your search for that elusive perfect home and make it even easier. So hop over to akiya-mart.com. That's AKIYA-MART, akiya-mart.com, and kick off your search today. There you go. Nice little collection of valuable info there. I hope you'll agree. Now, this second call is with a buyer from Australia. And again, we cover some of the topics discussed in the first call as well. But also, how does the distance to a major city play into property profiles and the number of feasible potentials, considering a limited budget, higher than the first one, but still not enough to buy a young property in the center of Osaka, which is the city that he's interested in? We also talk about picking the right location to appeal to short-term guests, leasehold versus freehold properties, and also a bit more about the purchase process itself, what and who is involved, how long every stage of the process takes, and so forth. So again, similar, almost same topic, but very different context and nuances. So enjoy the conversation, and I'll see you again one last time on the other side.
Okay, cool. So I've browsed through your email, but maybe give me a bit of a background first, and then we'll dive into your questions.
So I'm looking at purchasing a property. I've sort of been thinking about it for the last few months. And where I've sort of landed now after doing a bit of research is that I'm looking for a two-bedroom property, a 2DK or 2LDK sort of property. So it's something that can accommodate 4 to 5 people for a short-term rental. The thought behind the short-term rental is I would like to spend a bit of time there now and then into the future, even more time. So it's sort of just be to try and cover whatever costs and hopefully the loan repayments and stuff like that to cover as much of that as possible, and then go from there and be able to use the property for
When you
myself as well.
say 2DK, 2LDK, are you referring to a condo or a house?
A house, sorry, yeah.
A house, okay, because with a condo you can't do short-term rentals. The owner union has to allow it, and they never will.
That's what I'd read, but it's a bit of a minefield out there with so much sort of information when you're
Yeah, and then the
going into it.
other, we'll talk budget in a second and locations, but the other factor would be would so if you own the entire structure, you are allowed, if the local municipality regulations allow it, then you are allowed to rent it out short-term. But then the question would be where you've bought, is there licensed short-term stay management companies that can handle that area? That's not always going to be the case. So that would depend on your budget and location. And most houses also will not be 2 LDK. Most of them will be 3+ normally.
Yeah. So my thought behind that is, I don't know if it's coming from, you know, the norm in Australia, but just to be able to sort of accommodate sort of 2 to 3 to 5 people, and then also just have a bit of a communal area within the property as well.
We don't mind if it's 3 or 4 bedrooms. We just want it to be at least 2 bedrooms. Okay.
Gotcha. Yeah, correct. Yeah, just so there's, it's a bedroom for up to, 2 couples or 1 couple or whatever it might be, and then sort of a communal area as well.
Gotcha. And budget and location-wise, what did you have in mind?
So the budget, I'm looking about 12 million yen, I'm thinking. Yep. So about 130 Australian, give or take.
Including purchase costs, or is that just the listing price?
Yeah, so that's an entire. So from what I've gathered, that's probably somewhere around 10 million yen.
So, hopefully a bit less than that. So if we got 12 million yen, let's say worst case purchase cost would usually be not more than 15%. So let's divide that by 115 times 100. Okay, so about, let's call it 10 and a half million yen for the property price itself, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that should be doable with a fairly move-in ready home, as long as we're not too close to a major city. Where did you have in mind?
Osaka.
Osaka. Within 34, I mean, we'll get those properties within Osaka City itself, but they're going to be on the older side, and with Japanese properties not being built of very durable materials, that means a couple of thousand year in just maintenance and repairs, even if the property is in good structural condition when you buy it.
Yeah.
On average, if it's over 30, 40 years old, you're going to be looking at 2, 3, 3.5, worst case, hopefully, a year. Yeah. So it'll ebb and flow. Like, you'll have 5 years where everything's okay, then the roof goes for 3 million or whatever. So let's assume on average 2,000-3,000 bucks a year, depending on the age of the property, maybe a bit more.
And that was one of my questions, because in Australia it's, well, not so much these days, but traditionally properties are built to last sort of 100 plus years. So
not here. No,
which I did read, and that was sort of one of my questions, was the fact that coming from Australia, where most structures do last such a long time, what are the ongoing maintenance? Usually, I know it's a general sort of question, but what do the things that do pop up? You've mentioned roof, but
so roof, ceiling around windows, the non-durable materials, and the frequent earthquakes, which they're not all serious, but even small ones will slightly bend stuff, right? So.
Yeah.
Like window frames, doors, bits of the wall, caulking that needs to be redone, drain pipes that need to be reattached, just stuff that goes on with older age. We'd normally say, it's not all, like, if you buy in the countries, if you buy an old traditional pre-World War One kind of Japanese kominka, like a farmstead home in the countryside, they're built to last, the ones with the huge pillars and the thatched roofs.
Yeah,
but then anything you need to fix on those is going to cost 4 or 5 times as much, because they need specialized artisans, kind of people to work on them.
Yeah.
And the more modern ones, which is probably what you'll be looking at within the city, are not really built to last. So from a tax depreciation perspective, the wooden structures completely depreciate in 23 years.
Yep.
That's not to say that they can't be lived in, but when they reach about 30, 40 years of age is when you'll start seeing maintenance costs accruing on a more frequent basis annually. But Osaka is good for the short-term stay plan, because it's a special designated short-term stay friendly area. There you can actually rent out throughout the year, not just for 180 days, even if you don't apply for a hotel license.
Yeah, I did say that. That was one of the reasons behind it. So I sort of... going off, what I suspect anyway from the outside to be the three major markets in terms of short-term stays, I would presume would be, the three major touristy spots of Tokyo, Kyoto, and Osaka. And then looking at Tokyo properties, a little bit out of the price range. Kyoto, I've read that there's some restrictions in terms of
Super strict, very hard to get a license in Kyoto. Yeah.
Yeah, and for me, I'd prefer to probably be in Osaka or Tokyo when I'm visiting as well. So sort of left Osaka, and then they've obviously got the more lenient restrictions in terms of short-term stay. So that's how I landed on that. And in terms of location, for me personally, just from doing some research and looking at comments and reviews and whatnot on Airbnb, that the main sort of thing seems to be within 10 minutes of a train station. Anything further than that for most people seems to be a bit of a bugbear.
That's one of the things, but the other thing is because you're going to be renting it out short term, meaning those are people who are coming there to enjoy Osaka, right? They're not like tenants who need to go to work.
Yeah.
So except the 10 minutes to a station, you also need to be close enough for them to commute to the center without feeling it's too much of a hassle, right?
Yeah, correct. And that was the other sort of caveat I had for it was, sort of a 10 minutes to train and sort of half an hour to Umeda.
Exactly. Namba or Umeda. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the criteria.
That's good. You're a very educated, potential client. Most of them, we have to explain all of that.
Well, I actually work in property management, so
I do. Okay.
I deal with it every day. Yeah. Commercial side of things, but yeah.
Yep. Okay, so that all sounds fairly doable. Depending, again, I mean, the more central it is, the more likely it's gonna, like, for that price, you'll get something a little bit older and a little bit less in shape. So the closer to center will be, the more we're likely to have to renovate the interior to make it attractive to guests.
Yeah, and that's my thing. You do look at some of the listings on Airbnb, and you know, someone that might have a heap of reviews, which was obviously meaning that they've had a lot of people stay there, aren't necessarily a bright, beautiful, shiny building with everything brand new inside and everything looking magnificent. Yeah.
No, there's definitely a market for the older type properties, but they do have to be livable and comfortable, right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah. So that's sort of.
I mean, it's a very. The market runs the gamut. I mean, there are super fancy, luxurious Kyoto properties that rent out for $1,000 a night, and there's comfortable places close to the city that people rent on a budget. So both work, but we do need to make sure that everything is functional and comfortable, right?
Yeah. Of course. Yeah.
And also depending on the if short-term stay is definitely the criteria, then before we actually start looking at properties we will look at properties, but before we start making inquiries and organizing viewings and submitting offers, the first step would be to float them to a short-term stay research and management company and let them confirm for us how likely it is for that property to receive a license. And if it won't, what would need to be done to it in order for it to comply? Some things are quantifiable and doable, but if, for example, local regulations say you have to be within not less than 500 meter to a school, then renovations are not going to fix that. That property is going to be dropped, right? The short-term stay research company will charge 20,000 yen to research the first property in this particular municipality, and then 10,000 yen for every property afterwards if it is within the same municipality.
I presume I'll find this out later anyway, but is Osaka City, all of the wards, are they under the same municipality?
Anywhere in Osaka City itself would be. The only place which is fragmented is Tokyo, because it's not actually a real city. Each of those wards are separate cities. But Osaka City are all one municipality,
Excellent. I just sort of what you've the document you sent through sort of touches on the process, but I just sort of, from my point of view, sort of, could you walk me through it a little bit and sort of what's sort of required of me, just to sort of, I'm a bit of a visual learner and communicator, so it just helps me get it through my head a little bit.
Sure. So I'll break it down for you first, and then I'll caveat everything to explain about how we work at the moment, which is a bit different. So essentially, the way we normally work is you give us two documents that enable us to act on your behalf in Japan. One's our contract of services with you, and the other one is a limited power of attorney that's only related to property. Like, we can go buy yachts and jet airplanes and stuff. Yeah. And then based on that, we can then start contacting third parties and acting on your behalf. Mm-hmm. Before we can you know, we can have some back and forth about potential property listings and help you with some complimentary research and stuff like that. That's all. We don't need to get paid for that. But once you want us to start contacting third parties, making inquiries, making sure that everything is due diligence, organizing, scheduling viewings, whatever, at that point, we'll need to be paid. So yeah, we're paid. Essentially, if it's under 15 million yen, 5% of the estimated budget, and then post-settlement, whatever the end price was, we'll credit or debit accordingly.
Yeah.
Oh. And for that, that's a fixed price. For that, we will do everything on your behalf, and you'll just need to make bottom-line decisions. When it's time to transfer the property over to your name, there's a couple of documents you'll need to have signed and witnessed. But aside from that, you just need to talk to us and make decisions via email or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, excellent.
I'll talk about management in a moment, but first let me caveat all of that to say that we're a bit swamped with clients at the moment. We weren't really anticipating the growth that we had, so we now hired and training five new staffers, but until they're all up to speed, which is probably going to be early next year, we're not going to be able to do the full facilitation service. Since what I have been doing for customers since this started, which has been about 6 months now, is I've been putting them directly in touch with a foreigner-friendly realtor who is able to handle the purchase process, the logistics, everything in English remotely, same as we would have done. They're realtors, though, so the kind of conversation we just had about, you know, things to watch out for, prioritize, they're not going to have any strategic conversations with you. Their job is to either research or be pointed at a property by you and help you purchase it. That's what they're there for. So I've been coming in as a consultant for a few hundred bucks, which is also cheaper than hiring us full facilitation, and just holding people's hands along the process, raising red flags, reviewing documents before you sign them, guiding the agent on the due diligence we want to do, and so forth. So if it's via the consulting scheme, we can do that anytime. If it's full facilitation, that'll be early next year.
Yeah, that's fine. We can figure that one out.
So both ways work. The consulting way is a bit cheaper, but otherwise, and you'll have to talk to the agent with instructions, not to us. We'll just be on the sidelines consulting. But aside from that, the process is identical.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a bit cheaper with a lot cheaper with consulting. It's about 10% of what it would cost you for full facilitation.
Okay. Yeah. Beautiful.
Now, if you've attended any of our recent JREP Summit events in Tokyo or online, you've probably heard our sponsor, Robert Miller from Innovatius.com. He's been in WebDiz Solutions here in Japan for the past 25 years, and he's also an active investor in Japanese real estate property, as well as global online property, which is his specialty and what his company Innovatius is all about. They offer a full suite of website services for entrepreneurs and small business owners, including all aspects of web design and management, backup and updates, content formatting and editing, proactive maintenance and error fixing, you name it, with a strong focus on SEO excellence, which is what gets you those hardcore top-of-the-list search engine rankings. But there is a difference. Innovatius works off a simple, all-inclusive monthly subscription model, as opposed to the typical outdated and confusing project model. So you never have to wonder how much any request for any work to be done on your website might cost. It's always $497 per month. And if that's not enough, if you've mentioned you've heard of their services on the Japan Real Estate Podcast, you'll also get 10% off this monthly price for life. Also, and equally important, if not more, you can try out Innovatius for just 1 month, then switch them off, on again later if you want, and so forth. There are no minimum subscription terms. Now, if you're a small business owner, managing and growing a website is super distracting and time-consuming, right? That's exactly where Innovatius comes in. Robert's team takes care of all of that for you so that you can focus on what you do best. So feel free to email Rob on robert@innovatius.com, and his team will conduct a full SEO and website audit on your site, reveal anything that you should address to increase your website's appeal, and provide you with an easy-to-read detailed report with your own branding so that you can make some informed decisions on your online strategy and watch your business grow as you implement it. So once more, robert@innovatius.com. Drop him a line and get your website reviewed today.
One question I did have, and you saw you touched on in one of the emails that I sent, but I just wanted to get a bit of clarity on it, was just because I've tried to do a little bit of research, but haven't, yeah, found a little bit of conflicting information. But I sort of queried the old or new land leases and what the you said that you don't usually go for those properties. I just wanted to sort of get a bit of clarity on what the thought is behind that, because it just from the outside, it just looks like, oh, it's just a little bit of a fee. It's not too much. You just pay it yearly. It's not that bad. And the properties look a lot cheaper in some cases that
It
are
is,
under.
but depending on the exact nature, I'm not sorry, because we don't need deal much with leasehold properties. I'm not sure which is which, but I think the older leasehold law lets you renew it in perpetuity, and the new one actually has a expiry period, at which point the landlord may or may not renew it. And what the caveats there is, number one, if and when they don't renew it, you'll be up for the price of demolishing and removing the structure, because you own the structure, so you have to get rid of it if the landlord wants to claim the land back.
That would make
And
sense.
also, they don't stand to hold their value whatsoever, because the only thing that can gain in value or hold its value in Japan is the land. The structure always depreciates rapidly, so essentially they've got no resale value whatsoever, right?
Okay, that makes sense.
And obviously, banks will not lend for leasehold properties. So if and when you do resell it, you'll be limited to cash buyers as well.
Oh, okay, yeah, that would make sense.
And lastly, and most importantly, I'm not even sure leasehold properties can get a short-term stay license. That's something that we'll need to look into.
I thought that might have been that would be a possibility as well. So the one thing that I suppose the bit of trepidation for myself is getting the property. So like I will for me, I'll go over and have a look at the properties myself physically, just because I just don't think I could go through it without physically going and looking myself and getting a bit of an idea on the properties. Would you say that that's fair, or I know it's my own personal sort of feelings
It's very
towards it,
much a
but
personal choice. We have a lot of customers who are happy with us conducting remote viewings. Sometimes even the listing agent will be, I mean, they're Japanese, they're old school, so about 50% of them will not be able to wrap their head around the concept of Zoom viewing, but some of them do. We have had some cases. Most agents in Japan are pretty professional and by the book, but we have had a couple of cases where they kind of skimmed over problematic areas when they were doing the viewing.
Which I get,
So
because they're trying to sell
it's
the house at the end of the day, aren't they?
yeah, so it's a good idea to get at least us, if not yourself, to do the viewing for you. If we're there, we'll do it by the book. We're not going to skip anything, obviously, because our job is to point out those problem areas, right? But we do have a lot of customers that purchase with us conducting a remote viewing on their behalf. But if you are coming to Japan anyway, then I'd recommend lining up more than one property, like depending on how long you're going to be here, maybe five, six, 10 of them. And then we can either, if the agent's okay with it, we can just connect with you on the day via Zoom and provide interpretation, or we can join you on the day. But if we have to go in person, whether it's with you or by ourselves, there would be trip costs.
Yeah, of course. And
But if you are, sorry, but if you are going to be coming to view them in person, then there's no point looking at them until about a month before you arrive, because a lot of them will be gone by then.
okay, that makes sense. The in terms of when you are purchasing a property, what's the I don't know, it seems that Japanese people are very set in their way, so how are they in terms of negotiations and in terms of it, on not just price, but in terms of settlement, and what are the standard sort of settlement time frames, and how does that look, I suppose?
So negotiation-wise, Japan is not a super. It's properties are normally listed at reasonable market prices. So if we come in with offers that are more than 10 or maybe 15% off, we're not going to be taken seriously. So then we run the risk of that agent just ghosting us from there on, because nobody really offers. There's no lowball offer is not a thing here. Lengthwise, Normally, from the moment an offer is accepted, it will take about a month until we sign the contract and pay the deposit. They'll start working on the draft documents, forward us to review. We'll make some amendments maybe, and then forward back to them. So normally about a month to signing, at which point you'll pay the 10% deposit.
Yep.
If you need a structural inspection, which I would recommend if you're buying anything 30 years or older, then maybe add two or 3 weeks to that.
Yep.
So the way we'll do it is we'll submit the offer. On the offer, we'll note that it's pending a structural inspection report. And then once the offer has been accepted, we'll go ahead and commission the report, because there's no point for you paying for the inspection if it's going to be rejected, right?
Yeah, correct.
And then once we receive the inspection report and we review it, and assuming that we're good to go ahead, it will normally take from the moment the contract is signed and the deposit paid, normally about a month to settlement. So two or up to worst case 3 months with a structural inspection from the moment the offer has been accepted.
Yeah, which is pretty similar to Australia, probably 60 to 90 days is the norm. So and just on the property management side of things, you've probably already answered most of that question in terms of being able to discover, you know, what issues may lay in front in terms of getting a short-term license. And one question on the back of that as well. Once we've done the research, say I purchased the property, do you have any, what's the word I'm looking for? Do you have any contractors or anything like that that I would be able to reach out to in terms of, or the property management company, I would presume they would have contractors as well who they could have a conversation with to get the property up to was necessary.
Short-term stay property managers normally are not like your long-term stay property managers in the sense that they don't handle renovations and repairs. They might have some contacts, but they would normally let the landlord know, let the owner know that this and this needs to be done. And then it's kind of up to you.
Yep.
We can definitely put you in contact with them, but if you're not with the ones that we use, but if you're not fluent in Japanese, that's not going to work. So most of our customers use us to manage and supervise those works.
Okay. Yeah, excellent. Is that one?
And with management, hang on. Let me just open and share a screen with you. Give me a second. I'll forward those files to you later, but just so that we're reviewing them together now. Give me a sec. Share screen. There we are. So essentially, everything that's not included in the list that I'm just going to show you, we charge 4,000 yen per hour to manage any kind of non-routine work.
Yep.
And that's tax exclusive, so 4,400 yen.
Yep.
And these are your options for standard management, because essentially it's your holiday home that you'll need maintained regardless of, you're renting it out when you're not here, but essentially we're managing it for you. So if we're just signing up for utilities with or without internet insurance, giving you extra sets of keys, making sure fire alarms are working and handling your property tax every year.
Yep.
That will cost you about $1,000 to set up and then about 80, 90 bucks a month, depending on the exchange rates, for us to continue to be the contact person for that.
Yeah.
If you also need cleaning and airing company, then setup becomes a bit pricier and monthly, but I'm assuming if you're going to be working with a short-term stay management company, then it's most likely that you're going to be cleaning the house yourself when you're there, and when you're not there, the cleaners in between guests will probably do the job, so that might not be necessary. And you might, if the property for some reason is not renting out well and it'll stay vacant for a few months, which I hope will not be the case, but you might want us to just commission like a one-time spot cleaning for you kind of thing.
Okay,
in the interim. And then if it has a garden or a backyard and you also need us to be the contact person for a landscaping company, then that becomes a bit more expensive as well.
Yeah.
Right. And we've also got an additional option for people who want to make sure that they get priority support, and they can hit us up for any questions or requests up to 4 hours a month. And then there's an added option for like platinum support. We'll provide support to everyone, but people with that plan will be prioritized.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. That's essentially management. If the property really becomes an income driver and generates a large amount of cash, then we can switch over to a percentage-based billing for monthly. I mean, we can discuss it even when we see how successful it is. It's an option, though. Yep. Because normally for investment properties, we charge a percentage of the rental income.
Mm-hmm.
This is not exactly an investment property, kind of a hybrid. So we'll leave that option off for now, but it potentially could be an option as well.
Yeah, cool.
That's essentially it for management. I'll send you that document later on.
Perfect. Thank you. This is a long, long way down the track, but I'm looking at, you know, eventually, you know, paying this property off and then handing it down to someone, you know, a family member way, way down.
Sorry, paying off, you mean you're not eligible for a loan in Japan?
No. I get that. Just
on getting your investment. Okay, got it. Yeah.
So, and then, one day along the way down the track, I'll be looking at passing it on to someone. I also wanted to know, do you have any idea on what the costs and what the drawbacks are on that?
Passing it on as in giving it to them or selling it to them?
No, giving it to them. Yeah.
Then they would be up for gift tax. It might be a better idea to kind of concoct a thing where they're
very cheap sale.
Buying it from you kind of thing. Okay. Yeah. With your money maybe, and then giving it back to you. But essentially, if you give it to someone, and if it's a minor, you're not going to have the option to make it look like a sale as well. If it's a minor, then it's clear that it's a gift.
Mm-hmm.
Gift tax can be high depending on how much the property is valued at, somewhere between 10 to 50% even.
Yeah.
So best to avoid that if possible.
Yeah.
And then regardless of whether it's given or sold, then there would be, that's usually onus on the buyer, there would be legal and registration fees again, which is usually somewhere between 1 to 4%, depending on the official evaluation, which is always a bit different to market price.
Yeah. I think that's it. That's everything.
Yeah. And we'll have a lot more toing and froing when we're actually looking at individual properties usually.
That's covered everything, every query I had. So thank you.
Awesome. So if you want us to do everything for you and you're okay with paying the higher price, which is a few thousand bucks as opposed to a few hundreds, then we can get started with that early next year.
Yep.
If you want to pay less and or want to start earlier, then we can do it via consulting with an agent. Both ways work. So totally up to you.
Yep. Yeah, cool. I'll have a think about that. I'm not very patient normally, so I'll probably go with option B.
Not a problem. So if and when you want to kick that off, you've got my... you've got me on WhatsApp already. So just send me a message on WhatsApp and I'll kick off a chat group with the agent and we'll take it from there.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Pleasure. Talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
So there you have it. Akia buyers of the world unite, or at least we unite them for you here on the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Hope you've enjoyed this look at the different options available to different types of buyers in this space and the various things that need to be considered and reviewed when conducting these purchases. Let us know what you thought. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa, and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company, and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way.
And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time. And until then,